The Air Force A-10 Thunderbolt is one of the most effective aircraft in the fleet. Its project leaders say the Thunderbolt's simple design means its development time and maintenance costs beat out other more complex systems. But simple weapon systems are hard to come by now at the Department of Defense. Lieutenant Colonel Dan Ward, U.S. Air Force retired, is now cybersecurity fellow at the New America Foundation. And my guest on Pentagon Solutions today, his latest book is The Simplicity Cycle, and he's looking at simplifying national security. Dan, it's great to talk to you again. You have a terrific book. You have a terrific white paper that it is available. We'll link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth called Simplicity and National Security, and I appreciate having you back on the program. You write in this white paper, the issues of complexity often accompanied by an assumption that complexity is inevitable and must be simply tolerated. Fortunately, that's not the case. Why do you think we've gotten to where that is the case many times, Dan? Thanks for coming on, as always.
Hey, thanks again for having me, Francis. It's great to be on the show again. People have all kinds of funny ideas about simplicity and complexity. And like you said, a lot of times people assume that complexity is inevitable, it's unavoidable, and in many cases, desirable. In fact, I was talking with a gentleman on the phone the other day, and he said, we're not interested in simplicity, we fear simplicity, which I thought was a fascinating perspective.
And scary.
But, a little bit scary, for sure, for sure. But I understand the fear. I understand that perspective. And in large part, what I try to do with my book is to help address that fear and say, you know, yes, simplicity can be underwhelming. Simplicity is sometimes inadequate. But when you look at the actual data of military technology, of NASA technology, of any number of different categories, simple solutions, simple approaches tend to outperform their more complex alternatives.
Now, you and I talked before we went on the air about some of the work that Chuck Spinney did, and he wrote back in 1985, as the complexity of a weapon increases, its number of failure modes increases. And that seems like a logical progression to me, Dan. It seems like the more points where you have something that is possible, that it's possible for it to go wrong, the likelihood increases that something will go wrong. Is that a logical derivation, do you think?
Absolutely. It's not only logical, it's supported by the data of what things actually, how things actually performed in real life. And so we saw that in the 80s, several analysts and commentators, including Spinney, but a number of others pointed out that when complexity goes up, reliability goes down. And the data suggests that complex technology is usually relatively ineffective. But again, more recently in the 1990s, when NASA had their Faster, Better, Cheaper initiative, the difference between the successful Faster, Better, Cheaper missions and the failed Faster, Better, Cheaper missions, the primary differentiator was complexity. In fact, the more complex projects tended to fail or get impaired, really regardless of whether they spent too much money or too little money, too much time or too little time. Complexity was what really made the difference.
You and I have talked about FBC before, and I think it's appropriate to recap. This initiative started in the 1990s at NASA, and you're right, 9 of the first 10 FBC missions succeeded, and that includes the Mars rover Pathfinder, the near-Earth asteroid Rendezvous, Stardust, which was pulling particles from a comet's tail down to Earth. So 9 of 10 worked, and then in 1999, you write, 4 out of 5 FBC missions failed, and they got rid of the concept 2 years later. But it doesn't sound like, from what you're talking about, complexity versus simplicity, that all of the potential enumerators of the reasons for failure were considered.
Right. I think it's a politically tough decision to make when you have 4 out of 5 missions fail in a single year to say, oh no, our method is still good. We're going to keep doing this. You know, that is a tough sales pitch to make. I think NASA had the data to support that approach, and for whatever reason, they weren't able to make that happen. But when they went back and did the analysis and they looked at, okay, what went wrong in that later year, after a 7-year time period where they had a 90% success rate, which was far higher success rate than anybody anticipated, when they went back and looked at what went wrong, turns out in those final years, in 1999 in particular, complexity went up. And a number of projects sort of adopted faster, better, cheaper as a bumper sticker or as a slogan rather than as a deep engineering practice. So they talked the talk, but they didn't really walk the walk. And that's where things tended to crumble. But again, a big part of that came down to they made things more complicated, both their technology as well as their processes and their organizations.
Lieutenant Colonel Dan Ward, U.S. Air Force retired's new book is called The Simplicity Cycle, and a terrific white paper that goes along with it that focuses on national security, linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon, referencing both Spinney's work and more work by Sheila Tobias. You write, the clear implication of these studies is that complexity is neither inevitable nor desirable. Simpler alternatives exist and outperform their more complex counterparts. And then you tell the A-10 Thunderbolt story that I shamelessly stole from this white paper and used to introduce you, Dan. And that begs the question, when there are success stories right in our faces like the A-10, why it's so enticing or desirable, or maybe some people feel it's necessary to go a more complex route?
Well, sure. A lot of people look at complexity as a sign of sophistication. Complexity can be impressive. Complexity can be intimidating, and complexity tends to look like a lot of work has been done if you produce something that's very complicated. In fact, the simple, elegant solutions that actually perform better than their more complex alternatives are oftentimes the result of even more work and more effort and more skill, more talent, more insight. But a lot of that skill and hard work is sort of hidden because the final product looks simple, it looks obvious, but gosh, that's actually a much more disciplined, it takes a lot more discipline to produce a simple, effective solution. And not that every complex and expensive aircraft or weapon system is a failure. I mean, certainly some of those work, but again, the question of, is that complexity inevitable? Was it avoidable? Could we have gotten a better result if we had simplified, again, our processes, our technologies, and our organizations? And the data suggests the answer to that most of the time, the vast majority of the time, is yes.
I want to make it clear that your book, The Simplicity Cycle, is not a focus on defense issues only. Your white paper is focused on national security and supports the broader theories and concepts that you write about in the book, The Simplicity Cycle. What pushed you to write this? Is this an outgrowth of the book that you've written that we've talked about before, The Fire Book?
It is. It's very closely related. And in fact, this is the first book I pitched to the publisher. And I said, it's part of this larger concept called FIRE. And they said, oh, well, we'll write that book too. So we ended up publishing the FIRE book first. So yeah, The Simplicity Cycle is a piece of a larger concept about speed, thrift, and simplicity. But I really felt like I wanted to do a more in-depth look at the issues of simplicity and complexity in the things we design, not just from a military perspective, but really technology in general, and then it sort of broadened into how we structure our organizations, how we set our policies, and again, within civilian companies, within academic institutions, as well as military organizations.
Are the simplicity versus complexity arguments, challenges, attractions the same in other types of organizations as they are in the defense area?
I found them to be very, very similar. And when I talk with large companies and organizations, I found they're dealing with a lot of the same issues of bureaucracy, of slow decision making, of a preference for complexity, people who treat complexity as a sign of sophistication, and they'll even stand up and brag, hey, this is the most complicated thing we've ever built, as if that's a compliment to their creation. But absolutely, it happens in the Pentagon, it happens in large companies, it happens in small companies as well. So yeah, I wrote this really for as broad an audience as I could. It certainly can be applied and used within the military, but not exclusively so.
Is there a set of best practices that leaders can use to try to nip creeping complexity in the bud and make sure that it doesn't overtake one as one tries to lead a team forward?
Absolutely, and that's a large part of what I go through in the book, is identifying kind of where we're at in this cycle of, are we adding or are we subtracting? Are we making things more complicated than they need to be? And when we see that those dynamics are happening, there's a number of tools that we could use, different practices and techniques and approaches to help address that complexity and reduce it in a way that makes their final product better.
How much of those are policy, procedure, process, and how much of them are just cultural, getting people to think differently about the way they want to try to solve problems?
Well, I think the cultural piece is absolutely where you need to start. We really need to start by saying complexity is not always a sign of sophistication, that simplicity isn't necessarily something to be feared. And again, the heart of the book is to help us make good decisions about simplicity and complexity. And that really is a mindset shift rather than saying, hey, let's just add stuff as a way to make it better. Understand there is a cost associated with continuing to increase the complexity of the things we're making.
So one former very high-level uniformed official at the Pentagon used the term a long time ago with me, the 85% solution. As I read through the book and this paper, it strikes me that maybe that's even too complex.
I like the 70% solution myself. I'm happy to take the 80% solution as well, or 85. And in fact, that's kind of the idea, is that when we're setting out to pursue this hypothetical 100% solution, we tend to produce something that's over-engineered, that's gold-plated, and it ends up overreaching, when in fact a simpler, more restrained approach tends to get you a much better result.
I asked about the cultural versus the procedural differences. But I wonder if when you're thinking about it from a cultural perspective, if there's a potential solution where one of the requirements, no matter if it's a defense weapons system or some kind of a branding solution in the private sector or whatever, if theme number one should be what do we want to do and what's the easiest way to do it?
Yeah, that's a great start. And I should also point out that there's plenty of room to make improvements in the procedures as well. We need to focus on culture and procedure both. Starting with, hey, what's the easiest, simplest way to go forward is a nice place to start. We do want to be careful with that because, there's a saying, for every problem, there's a solution that is simple, easy, obvious, and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make sure we avoid that. And I go into that in the book as well.
And what's the process for that evaluation, Dan?
It comes with asking that question of what constitutes goodness. A lot of our problems really come from bad definitions of good, where we overvalue things that don't actually make the thing better. And so when we say, okay, what does this really need to do? What are we really trying to achieve here? What does it need to carry? What does it need to convey? What does it need to perform? And focus on that. And then we say, okay, well, what's the easiest way to do that? Is that adequate? And then, hitting that 70% solution, putting it out into the world, and getting that actual real-time feedback and saying, okay, now we move on to the next iteration, the next block, the next version.
We hear a lot in government right now about agile development. And as you mentioned that idea of looking at something, making sure it's functional before you proceed, it sounds like that's a similar approach. Is that necessarily, though, a guarantee of success? Because it seems to me if you lose track of that original idea of what goodness looks like, doesn't matter how fast your iterations are, you're going to wind up in the wrong direction.
Sure. So I'm a big fan of Agile. I think there's a lot of benefit we can get in the military and in the private sector, both from using those Agile methods and Agile mindset. But no, it's certainly not a guarantee of success. And anybody who's trying to either find or sell a guaranteed solution that will fix all our problems is not somebody I would spend a whole lot of time listening to. But there's a lot we can do with Agile. It really does address a lot of the key problems and challenges within the Pentagon acquisition community. So I'm hoping to see that get adopted more. But again, certainly it's not a fix-all. It's a cure-some, not a cure-all.
What's the response like to the concepts that you're laying out there, Dan? I can imagine there are some corners where these are not particularly popular.
That's correct. In some places, it's very popular, and people are happy to have this kind of stuff out there, and in other places, less so. Certainly we see Mr. Kendall, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics, in January put out his proposal to help simplify the way we do acquisitions, clarifying some of the oversight, clarifying some decision-making roles, and reducing the amount of documentation needed. But a couple of years back when I was at the Pentagon, I was part of a team that was charged with, again, reducing the documentation required. And we went through this big list of all the reports that were required. And over my objections, what the team's final recommendation was to add two things to that list, not to take anything away, even though taking it away, simplifying it, streamlining it, was what we were supposed to do. Even when we're given direct direction to, hey, go make this big list smaller, that team ended up making it bigger.
if we can, let's deconstruct that for just a second, because that's exactly the kind of thing that I think somebody, for example, a member of Congress would look at and say, this is a textbook example of the problem that we face. When you think about that particular instance, and I'm not going to ask you to call anybody out or anything, but what was it that caused the logic to proceed from, let's figure out how we can do less of something, to winding up, we need to do a little bit more of something?
Right. I think a lot of it had to do with the lack of priorities and a lack of willingness to make decisions. They said everything is important, everything matters to somebody, and oh, hey, we even overlooked these other two things, and those are important, and those matter to somebody, so let's include those too. But there wasn't a willingness to take a hard look and say, you know, what really matters? What really helps program managers manage their programs? What really helps executives make their executive-level decisions? And which of these reports are really lagging indicators or, you know, compliance-only documents? And DoD Instruction 5002 explicitly says we're not supposed to be producing compliance-only documentation. The purpose isn't to check a box. It's to provide timely and relevant information to the people who need it. And there were several of these reports that I said, hey, these are clearly unnecessary, low value. We could get rid of these and it wouldn't have an impact. But my objections were overruled, and we ended up, again, keeping them all and adding two more for good measure.
Well, Dan, I want to congratulate you on the new book. I'm pleased to see that it's out there and getting a good reception, and this white paper is also excellent, and I'm happy to link it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and I look forward to continuing this dialogue as you continue to discuss these issues. Thanks for coming on today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's great to chat with you.